This is Linda Johnson taping with Apple Vertalik. It's in Whitehorse at the Yukon Archives, June 11, 1991. Also with us is Diane Chisholm and Donna McBee of the archive staff. And we're just in the process of receiving from Apple some tapes that she did as part of her career as a broadcaster and oral historian here in the Yukon in the 1960s. And we're going to just go through the collection and briefly talk about how the work was done and some of the stories associated with getting the tapes. Okay. I've grouped the tapes somewhat according to topic. And so why don't we start with the Gold Rush, which seems to have a number of interesting sessions with old-timers who are long since gone. Maybe we could just stop for a moment, though, and say that these tapes were mostly done in Dawson City?
Yes, they were all done in Dawson City, yes. Yeah, I arrived in Dawson in 1955, and nothing too much happened then until, I think, 61. And I realized that no one at that time was doing much about Dawson. Pierre Burton had been in and out, but no one was doing the day-to-day things, so this is how I got started. And you just don't walk up to a person and say, tell me the story of your life. Now, someone tried that and got a very cool reception. So it took a while. We visited, and I didn't have really an ulterior motive. I wasn't in there to make tapes. This just sort of evolved, and I realized the things that I was hearing should not be lost. So over the years, I got to know these people. Now, Mrs. McDonnell lived down the street from us, and she came into the country, I think she'll say on the tape when she came in, about 1900, and her husband was a liquor vendor in the old liquor store, and they lived over the liquor store. There was a balcony that leaned out over the street, and she said that they used to bring the liquor in condensed form, the whiskey, and then her husband would water it down to a certain degree to measure up to Yukon standards. And she had an old corker in the corner, not her husband, she had a corker, a little corker in the corner. And so all that was part of the liquor store story was Mrs. McDonnell, a very charming lady. She was around during the festival and was considered one of the characters of Dawson during the festival. So that's Mrs. McDonnell. Now she probably talks about coming into the country and being down river and so on. In fact, I forgot quite what's on there. Mm-hmm. So that's Mrs. McDonnell. Uh-huh. Then this one. Chester Henderson is an unusual tape in the sense that Chester was one person whom I really wished to talk to. Very, very shy man. And at first he said, oh, no, I don't want to do that. Then he reconsidered and he said one day, all right, I'll do it, but I don't want this broadcast on your show while I'm alive. And I said, well, that's fair enough. I wasn't that eager or hungry to do these things. I thought probably he'd outlive me anyway. But so that was the understanding, that this tape would not be broadcast. So when you hear it, outside of myself and my family, you'll be the first ones to hear this Chester Henderson in his own gentle way. And he corrected a few things that have been written about the Yukon, his own very quiet, very gentle.
How old would he have been when you did that tape?
Probably about 50, maybe. Probably 50. I don't know whether he says on then he was born or not. Probably it could be on the tape how old he was. But no, he wasn't an old man.
That would have been in the late, that would have been about 1962 or 3.
Something
that
like that,
him?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I've got May the 1st, 1962. So yeah. That was when that was done. Now, where do you want me to put these? Now, this Pioneer Dinner was an annual affair in Dawson. 1st of December every year. They still do it for that matter, where all the pioneers gather and have a dinner. It wasn't the best of tapes. I had some assistance from somebody else who wasn't used to doing interviews, and they're lumpy and jerky. However, as far as I know, all these men came in during the Gold Rush.
Louis
Rowell. He was French. She apparently had a huge hay ranch up the river someplace and raised hay for all the horses. Monty Balch, he was a miner up the creek. Well, I wish I could remember these, but I think you may get the drift of it. Teddy Watch, he was around the theater quite a bit. He wasn't part of the theater, but he sort of appointed himself as a security person or a raconteur, and so he used to talk about the early days in Dawson. But I'm sure you'll get something out of it. It's not all that great, but there'll be something in there anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe, I'm sure it's the only time we'll have those particular individuals on tape.
You'll hear their voices anyway, mm-hmm. Let's put it that mm-hmm. way. Johnny Drabson, he mined up El Dorado. A real gentleman. He had the neatest little cabin, and he had mined there for years and years and years. He talks about the creeks and what had happened up there. As I see, I have his date here. Born 1873 and died January 11, 1965. And George Clark, if I'm correct on this one, he had such badly damaged knees from working in the mines that he pulled himself around town on inner tubes, you know, or tires, mm-hmm. sort of pushed himself along like this. He wasn't the world's most delightful person. He didn't suffer his incorrectitudes very well, but anyway, everyone is surprised that I did get a chance to talk with him. So he'll talk, I think, about his mining days, and a lot of them were trappers too, and this is how they supplemented their income, trapping in the winter and mining and prospecting mostly in the summer. Mm-hmm. So that took its toll on him. But anyway, he was one of the characters. Now, Mr. Corbel, another gentleman, he came up from Puyallup, I think he said in 1897, so he was ahead of the gold rush. He didn't know anything about the gold rush and went through the circle. And then he backtracked to Dawson. And he lived up, then he came to Dawson and he mined. I'm not just sure who Mrs. Corbel was, but his daughter became Millie Swartz, and she was a White Pass agent there for years and years. And they tell the story about him having this beautiful white horse. He didn't tell me this. I had to pick these stories up around the community. He had this beautiful white horse, and they were up the creek. And when the baby was born, apparently the mother wasn't too well. And Mr. Corbel would ride that horse all the way into Dawson to buy milk for his baby and then ride it back. They often wondered how good the milk was, but how long they kept it there. But Millie thrived. She was a very busy, ambitious, nice-looking lady. So Mr. Corbel, in his white horse, was quite something. But when I tried to get him to... See, he knew Jack London, and he knew Service. Service didn't rank all that great. He was that funny guy that sat up in the hill, you know, and wrote things. And he knew Jack London, but Mr. Corbel would not gossip. You know, it would break your heart, because I knew he was full of stories.
The best stories.
But he'd just take us up so far, and then he'd say, but then I was up the creeks quite a bit, and I didn't know him very well, so I knew that was the end of the story. So anyway, those are gone. And so anyway, that was Mr. Corbel, and it's quite a lengthy one. A lot of long spells in there, dead air, just the rocker creaking, and then he'd get back on track. But he couldn't be rushed, and we were more friends than anything. I mean, I wasn't there just trying to pick his brains or anything. So those were just fun to do. I enjoyed doing those. Now, Mrs. Vifkin, she was really something. She came in as a child. Her uncle was Pinkerton's detective agency, and she came in with her uncle as a child. And she had more vitality. When Mrs. Vifkin left a room, you were aware she'd gone. A very, very well-dressed woman, very fussy about her appearance. Her hair was always just so, and her nails were always polished, and she always wore her jewelry. And she was Mrs. Zaccarelli, who owned Zaccarelli's store.
Yes. And
so the Zaccarellis and the Vifkins were very, very good friends. So it came time to go. So Mrs. Vifkin and her two sons went out to California, where they were going to open up another bookstore. So she and the two boys went, which left Mr. Vifkin and Mr. Zaccarelli and his sister, Mrs. Vifkin, and their two children. So they were all going out on the last boat. Well, Mr. Zaccarelli got to Skagway, and his sister was there, Mrs. Vifka, with her two children. So she wanted to go out on another boat. And so he switched things around so all three of them were on the, the two children and the two adults. Brother, sister, and two children were on the Sophia. And of course, that's what happened. Of course, it hit Vanderbilt Reef, and I did quite a lengthy story on that. So she came back, and she told me she had to identify the bodies at Juneau. And she said they looked just like slabs of liver. They were so rolled in heavy fuel oil from the ship because the tanks ruptured. And she said she walked into this warehouse, and here she said just like straight slabs of liver, that she had to identify these. So then she came back and married Mr. Vifkin, and this is... she was at, they called her, she worked in the NC for years, and then I think she and a friend ran a hotel, and they called her the boss. Boss Vifkin. And she was just a, she babysat for us, and that's another story about that. Now, Louis Cardinal, I hope the whole thing is here. Louis came in from Fort Knox for some special, oh, of course, you see, it was festival year. Everything happened to festival year. He came in for some special event. And
this would be 1962.
1962. And he was 87 then. And I don't know whether it's on tape or whether that tape got messed up somehow or other. He told me that he had been a special counsel with the Northwest Mounted Police. And he had been in the pass with Colonel Steele, where they met all the incoming stampeders, and he said he manned a Gatling gun. They weren't going to take any chances, and Colonel Steele was a very, very strong, stern man. And then I think he handled the dogs and ran the mail for the RCMP. The RCMP had the first contract, as you know. And it seems to me he ran the mail as part of that Northwest Mounted Police. Mm-hmm. So I've
never heard that, so that's a wonderful story to pursue.
I hope it's all on there, but yeah. He did tell me that if it's not on the tape. And this is Mr. Corbett, whom he's, I didn't realize that. It says it's a good copy. Okay, this is 63, you see, this is getting along. And he came in 1897. So the Corbett one we've been.
So shall we turn to, this one is another one of Mrs. MacDonnell.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. She talks about getting on that first train and going up
the Klondike
Railway to Grand Forks. And she talks about all the people that were on, all the things he did, and it sounded very exciting. Now, Dick Gillespie, this is a modern one. Obviously, I did it in 1961. My husband was president of the Klondike Visitors Association, and there were two or three engines over at Loustown, as they called it. And we used to go over there just for walks. And these engines were there, obviously not being cared for, and they weren't going to be there much longer. So Tom talked to Dick Gillespie, who owned equipment in Dawson. And Dick said yes, he'd like to do it for the community. And things weren't all that easy. You know, using your cap and burning up your fuel and using your time, I always felt he deserved a lot of credit. So it was no small operation to get that thing across the ice and get through them, But the whole story's in there, all about the tonnage and how he had to go about over the river and everything. So that one is particular interest to Dawson. I think they're trying to do something about those engines. Mm-hmm. So I see I've got part two on there.
Is he still alive?
Oh, yes. Yeah, Dick's a comparatively young man. He's in Dawson.
He's in Dawson.
Oh, yes. Yeah, he's still there. Let's see, he's comparatively young. He's probably the age of my son or something like that.
Okay, so he's someone that would really appreciate knowing that this story
Yes, I'd
here.
Like to think it's done. He's a very quiet man, and he would be the last person to suggest that he could be given any credit for it. Mm-hmm. Alec Adams, he used to be around the old Palace Grand. Now, he told me in his early days he was a song and dance man, an entertainer. And the way he loved that old theater that was falling down around his ears, I'm inclined to believe him. And so he goes on, I think, at some length about the Palace Grand, because they used that until it was practically condemned. They called it the Nugget Dance Hall. There weren't any grants in those days. Anything you did, you were entirely on your own. So we wanted to raise money. We went out and played for dances and put on Klondike Nights and met the boats and raised money. This is how we bought the Palace Grand Theater. We had a whole $1,000 at the end of our year of meeting the boats, putting on our gambling nights, shooting Dan McGrew, and then having a dance. And we did this all summer long. There would be about 20 of us in Dawson with the hardcore that would do this. So when the festival arrived, well, first of all, we had this $1,000, and we wanted to buy the Yukon Hotel because it was crammed with treasures. It even had a huge piano in there. They called them a parlor grand or something. Looked like a community casket. It was the most enormous thing you ever saw. Great enormous legs on it. And trunks full of feathers and gowns and a silver tea service, if I remember correctly. So I went through with the sheriff. So we decided, oh, if we had that, we could really set up the museum. So we was up for bid, and we bid $1,000. And somewhere along the way, somebody else bid $1,200 in Alaska. And they came over with trucks and cleaned it out. Even the aircraft that came over for the bond spills was a good-sized aircraft, and he even loaded that up, so that disappeared. That went to Alaska. We were just heartbroken, but there wasn't a thing we could do about it. But we still had $1,000, a whole thousand. We used to gamble with phony money. Once my husband and I were in Anchorage, we got a wire from Dawson. They were going to put on a special Klondike night. And so this friend of ours, Mac Monroe, said, Tom, where's the $1,000,000? Well, this looked great on the telegram. It was all our phony money we'd put away. So anyway, we had still had the $1,000. Well, the old Palace Grand was falling apart. It was in terrible shape, and I don't think they'd let us use it anymore anyway. And the city fathers, bless their hearts, kept upping the taxes in that place because some man from Davenport, Ohio, owned it. And he'd appear every so often and sleep on a mattress at the theater, apparently a very well-to-do man. And then he started talking about tearing it down and selling the lumber around town. So the city council just kept upping the taxes to the point he lost interest in it. So we scurried with our $1,000 and bought the Palace Grand. And then what do you do with a Palace Grand that's falling down and you're dead broke? So that is when Dawson's really, you know, things were about bottom. I guess
that's the beginning of the Klondike Visitors Association.
It had started just before we got there. We called it the Yukon Visitors Association. No, we called it the Klondike Tourist Association, and then someone knew more about these things, said, oh, don't use the word tourist, that's not a nice word, use visitors. And I remember it was quite a hot meeting to get this name changed, but they had started before we got there. No, we didn't start this, but it was underway, sort of. And then, of course, was when the federal government stepped in and said they were going to put on a festival. Of course, we thought they'd lost their minds completely. Tom Patterson arrived on the scene, and we knew who Tom Patterson was. He was going to put on a festival with a Broadway company. And we thought, oh, well, that's fine. You want to come in here and daydream, that's nice of us. No matter what happened, it was a disaster, as everyone knows. But you have to have Tom Patterson's in your life. Otherwise, nothing would ever happen. So, you know, the rest of us can keep our feet in the ground. We need these people on cloud nine. Well, the festival is a story in itself, and most of it totally unbelievable. We just about brought down the government, and Anna was told we were building a monument to a whorehouse. It was just terrible. In the meantime, they had hired a whole Broadway company, a whole company, and then there was some money somewhere. I was a vice president. Next thing we knew, that the company was in Vancouver, and Bert Lahr would not fly. He was coming up the coast, but they still needed their pay. The whole company was $17,000 a week. I just would win $17 million. So then the territorial government got mixed up in it, and this, theoretically, it was before we had any party politics in the Yukon. You represented your area, and you were never quite sure what the leanings were. But about that time, it was starting to show its little head. And some of the council members said, no way, we were not going to support this thing. And George Shaw, he went to bat for us. I came into town too. I was always right in there where everything was happening to see what we were going to do. And so they decided to support it. But Ottawa kept saying, the wire that I saw was build and pyramid. Well, there was no place for these people to stay, so a number of businessmen in Whitehorse got together. I think they put in around $15,000 and dragged in trailers down to Dawson and set them up there in the old hospital site, and those were quarters for the Foxy Company, right straight from New York. And the Palace Grand, of course, was just about finished. And when Parks Canada does anything, believe me, it is done properly. They strip wallpaper down, about five layers down. I was always there, right at their elbow. They found the original paper. They tracked that down and found that paper had been printed in San Francisco. And so that's the paper. Someone had a couple of old chairs that they had put in the palace, that had been in the Palace Grand. They were old, like kitchen chairs, very high back with little pads on them. So those were duplicated. And I think they made 501 so that we could get a special permit to serve liquor in the bar. We had to have over 500 seating before you could get a bar license or something like that. So that one chair was always up there very often. It went from the sublime to the ridiculous. They swore if we wrote another check, we'd all end up in jail. And then people kept arriving on the scene with contracts. Somebody called Bob Darch arrived. He was the official pianist from Alaska, and he said, oh, I'm here to entertain on the keel. So there was Pierre Burton and Roy Minter and my husband and a few more people, and we went down and built furniture on the keel because we had to have some place to make money. And so here Bob Darch arrived. He had a contract. And then somebody called Pam Hyde, who was a singer from Toronto. She had a contract. We didn't know what to do with these people. So then we said, okay, we'll put them on the keno and we'll charge the earth for drinks. I think we charged $1.75, which was unheard of. And then we were renting out the rooms, those little narrow cabins, you know, with a wash basin in the corner and the slop pail underneath. And people were paying just to sleep on the steamboat. It was utter bedlam. It's an unbelievable story. So the three local bars said around town, if you think we're paying our taxpayers money to pay for these people to come in, to entertain on the boat, to take all our patrons away from us, no. So the upshot was that they played in the bars Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, but we still had some more days to make money in. So guess who went down and played honky-tonk piano four nights a week? So I'd get all decked up in my costume and pile some more red hair on top of my head, and away I'd go. So I just beat that piano. Charlie Rendell, who was a banjo player. So we put on a show to make money to pay for these people who had gotten contracts in Ottawa that we didn't know anything about. It got sillier as the time went on. It really did.
It sounds like it was fun, though.
Oh, we had a wonderful time. Just ran ourselves right. But anyway, that's the festival story, or part of it. So this is Alec Adams, who was the beginning of the song and dance man in the old Palace Grand, and he was sort of a caretaker, I guess he would be. And then, of course, A.Y. Jackson pretty well speaks for himself. It just so happened that was his 80th birthday when he was in Dawson. He was there for a week painting, and I got to know him quite well. And so I did a time story on him, and then the interview. And I think only Dr. Jackson could do. I see there are two of them there. So
there's two A.Y. Yeah. Jackson, but you only did one interview with him.
No, I think there. I think there must have been a double interview or something. Uh-huh. So I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave it up to you. Uh-huh. I'm awfully tired of going through these tapes. You know, before
I bet.
You know.
Okay, well here's a whole series of Steamboat.
Okay, well, Mrs. Vifkin, I've told you about Mrs. Vifkin, and she's talking about the early day breakups and the first boats on the river. So I think that, I think, will be a straight go. She was a good subject to interview.
Okay.
And Johnny Hogan was another excellent. Now, this is three parts, a four-part series. So he talks about the steamboats and the incidences of, I think, when they shot a hole in a load of dynamite or something,
right,
and all those good old...
And his father was Captain Hogan.
He mentions his father, yes, but he was a deep sea captain.
And was he working on the boats here?
I don't think so. They were up in Kluane, and I don't think anything to do with it. I think so. And Johnny, of course, was on the steamboats. But this will be a straightforward tape. He spoke well. He had excellent memory, unbelievable memory. And this is Johnny Hogan again on the steamboats. So that'll be part of that whole thing. I guess they'll probably work together. I would do a whole 6 weeks because I had a Friday night slot. And so while we're going away, I would do several ahead and then break them up into segments. And this is a contemporary course. This is Joe Langevin had talked about his Yukon River trip, and he went all the way from Dawson to St. Michael, and he was very observant. So it's a good tape about a downriver trip. And steamboating on the Yukon, I'm afraid you're going to be on your own for this one too. 1971. That's 7 years of stretch. And then Johnny Hogan again, part four. So I did it in a whole series, and you'll probably find it. A continuity from one take to the other.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Then this group is more Johnny Hogan.
Okay. Yeah, you'll appreciate those. They're really good. Good memory, articulate. And there's Johnny Hogan. He walks through Dawson.
Yeah, if you could just tell the story about how you did these two walking tapes.
Yes,
with
as
him.
I said, I was going out on vacation for 6 weeks, and I had to have programming material. So I had a panoramic picture of Dawson, a very early picture, and it was really at its height. So we just stretched this out on the coffee table, and we started far end as though Johnny were taking me for a walk. And he talked about every building in the picture, and there were many of them. Sawmills and ice sheds and all sorts of things. And then I had about a 20-minute slot, so I'd cut it. And then we'd start over again. This is Arthur Italic and Johnny Hogg, and then as though we were a week apart. So I did this for White Horse, to walk through White Horse in the old days. And there's some really quite remarkable things about the... and they had a town pump in the middle of White Horse. And that's where they used to water the horses and the dogs, and the people would come and they had water wagons, and they'd come and get their water. Mm-hmm. So he speaks about that in some detail. So I got to walk through Dawson and a walk through White Horse, just using these panoramic pictures and there.
Wonderful.
Oh, here's the walk around White Horse. That's it.
So I'm sure these two tapes, the Dawson walk, would be, I'm sure, of interest to the Dawson Museum.
Yes, they would like that.
And the walk around White Horse, there is a walking tour of White Horse sponsored by the Yukon Historical Museums Association. So
sure.
Some of that
might
be of interest when the booklet's revised, and would certainly be of interest for the tour guides that lead the tour each summer.
Yes.
We hire students every summer to
do the
guiding.
Sure.
And they're always looking for anecdotes from old timers to use.
It's a shame they're lost. I did a tape for the Bank of Commerce in Dawson, and one of the men who had worked in the gold room, and we went up, and he just did the whole gold room. And I left the tape there, and there was honky-tonk music background, and somebody took it. It just vanished. I had a thank you letter from the president of the bank, and a year later they went back and it was gone. So these things do happen.
That says Dawson Waterfront, and then a whole list of people.
Yes, I started at the north end of the waterfront in Dawson, and it just so happened there was a Brainstorm, which was a boat that took supplies to Old Crow every year. It's almost a little story in itself. And then Weldon Farr and Sid Jackson were men who worked on the Dawson Ferry. That was a whole summer occupation. And then Donnelly, Connolly Dawson Airlines, Jim Reed, he was a pilot, and his plane was tied up there. And he was so pleased to be doing this that he said, well, just get these engines, and what did he call them? Anyway, the same engine they used in the Royal Royals. So I stood there, and you'll hear the engine and the pontoons, and they just get up on the step before they lift. And I found it quite an exciting tape to do. And the Yukon Belle, that was a little boat that was put on during the festival, little Yukon River tours, I think, down to the Indian village. And then, of course, the helicopters were there, and Chuck Hankin, I think he just left here not too long ago, and he was an engineer on the helicopters. So we got the helicopter, and I talk about that. And then Pat Collison, who owned the helicopters at that time, and this Alain Duclos, obviously was a French pilot, and he was killed out here near Haines. He crashed, one of his passengers walked away. But he had been a helicopter pilot in Algiers, and it seems so sad that he came up here and we're so peaceful and quiet. So that is the Dawson waterfront. All the activities were on that summer.
This is side two of the tape with Athol Retallick, Linda Johnson, Diane Chisholm, and Donna McBee talking about Athol Retallick's tape collection of Yukon history.
So I just said, it was such a pleasure for me to do it because I was not going in as a professional journalist. They became my friends. That was quite necessary, very proud people, and they were good people. So I had the good fortune, we lived in Dawson for 12 or 13 years, and over the period of time, you see, I got to know them, and they trusted me. They'd hear my broadcasts and realize that I wasn't destroying anything, so this is how I had the good fortune to get it. It was a wonderful time, really.
What did they think about hearing themselves on national radio?
They're very sophisticated. They'd seen so much of a good life in Dawson that as far as that was concerned, when Bert Lahr came to Dawson, people just nodded and went on their way. He found he could sit out there in front of the cafe. I doubt if three people in Dawson ever asked him for an autograph. Maybe the people that came in from other places probably asked him, but no, that was Dawson. They're actually quite sophisticated because everyone, sooner or later, got to Dawson. The Lord Mayor of London and I think president of every banana public came in on the Klondike when they were running it on the river. Well, Dawson was a surprisingly sophisticated, and I don't think these fellows gave it much thought, really. I don't know. At least that was the impression I got.
Now, here's one that we hope is on the tape.
Oh, I do hope this. I went into Old Crow. And the RCMP lined up all these people for me, and then I interviewed them. I guess it was the first time anyone had ever really gone in there and worked on it. And I only hope that it's there. What it's there, I really can't, I'm not sure.
Reverend Simon and Mrs.
Yeah, Reverend
Simon,
Mrs. James
yeah.
Simon and Abraham Peter and Stephen Frost and John Kenty, he was the riverboat pilot. And Peter Charlie and Robert Bruce. I'm sorry that it was really a very good trip in. But one was sort of funny. This one went international, and Reverend Mrs. James Simon, and as I was interviewing him, she kept chirping along, reminding him. So when someone somewhere heard it, they said, "It would be better if you didn't prompt because we're finding it difficult to sort this out." So I had to tell him I wasn't prompting. It was little wife chirping along and just telling him what she thought he should say. And if it wasn't right, she'd tell him she'd. So if it's there, that's what this is all about. So I just hope it's there. I can't promise that.
Mrs. Simon has done a little booklet now based on their photograph album.
Well.
I'll try and get you a copy of it, because you've met them. I feel quite fascinating, yeah.
Did you interview each of them in their own home, or?
No, I didn't. It was cold. I froze my face on that trip. The RCMP lined them up almost like a dentist's office, and they were out there, and they'd come in two by two, because we didn't have much time. We chartered to go in there. Myself, and a plumber, and a salesman, I think, went in Old Crow. And so we split the charter and went in, and I did my thing, and they were doing theirs. They were building something up there, and they were putting plumbing in. So no, I just sort of whistled them through. But I find native people are excellent to interview. You probably find that out too. They're natural orators. They have no difficulty in expressing themselves, and their English language is, you know, you couldn't ask for anything better, but it's the ease with which they talk. And they were great to interview. Gosh, I didn't
also, hours.
Yeah.
How long did you stay there that time?
Just a day and overnight.
Mm-hmm. And in that day, did you stay in the RCMP?
Yes, I did.
House?
Corporal Bates was there, and his wife and two children. And
that would have been
mother.
Early 1960s? What does it say?
I think so. It doesn't say anything.
63 or 64?
Something like that. Yes, it would have been. It was bitterly cold. And I was walking along with a tape recorder and my overnight bag and a camera, and then these little Indians came along and said, "Ooh, lady, your nose is froze." It was.
Oh, dear.
So, but that was quite an interesting trip in there, too. So we're getting down now.
Well, this is Reverend Martin.
Oh, Reverend Martin. Yes, he, I think I've got most of him. I say some of these got sort of messed up a bit between here and there. But he was an ordained minister, and I think he mentions on there that he and his father shot game up in the Dempster country because it was just teeming with game, and they brought it in and sold it to the restaurants, moose, and sheep, and deer. And I think he said they were 25 cents a pound or something they got at the restaurants for these live meats. And then he was a minister. He lost his sight, and I think he mentions the fact that a gun exploded or something, mm-hmm. and he lost his sight, and he was just a young man. Mm-hmm. And the dredge sounds, I realized that they were closing the dredges down, so I went out with my tape recorder, and that's all there are, just dredge sounds, moaning, groaning, squeaking, screeching.
Eerie,
you know,
eerie.
Sound like it. On
make
your
back.
Yeah,
crawl.
So those are dredge sounds. And I gather I talked to somebody on the dredge when they were closing out, so that's more of the temporary.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Like so.
And festival.
Festival. I guess
now,
I'm surprised
there's only two dates on the festival.
I did keep a journal. All during the festival, because I knew I was entering something that was the most unbelievable thing that was ever going to happen. I did the interviews, and mine got lost. Fortunately, Bill Herbert was everybody was in Dawson for the festival, just everyone. And so he did some interviews, and the music is on there. Oh, marvelous music. We went to New York and heard Foxy or saw Foxy again, and I'm so sorry the music was lost. Just when you hear it, you'll just hear. And it was all specially written for Dawson. Rolling in Gold and Larceny and Love and marvelous things. So that is about the festival. And this would be, I've got Dawson Museum. I think they're trying to get together the story of the Dawson Festival. And so many stories have come out. It's typical of the Yukon. You can't tell any lies about it because the truth is more fantastic than anything you can dream up about the festival. So that would be on the opening of the festival, I guess. And then in the middle of all this excitement, Bee Lilly arrived by helicopter. And she was the funniest thing. And, you know, she didn't know anything about the country. I don't think she really knew where she was. And you can hear, and I'll say, well, what, you know, how do you feel about the country? Well, she'll say, well, you name some places, and I'll tell you what I think of them. You know, she was really something. She stayed there 3 or 4 days, and she just loved the place. As I say, I don't think she had the vaguest idea where she was. And Bert Lahr, of course, came in as Bert Lahr and a star, and very reserved. I think he was afraid of the crowds. Well, he needn't have worried, because that wasn't Dawson's way. So then things went from bad to worse in the festival. The people just couldn't get in. They were guaranteeing hundreds of thousands of people and plane loads of people and all this sort of nonsense. So the crowds were poor, and things were really, they were rounding people up and bringing them into the theater. And then a story, somebody blew into town and wrote a story and quoted Bert Lahr as saying that even the Indians folded their tents and faded into the night. Well, of course, Wild Time immediately called me and said, what is this? So I spent an awful lot of time with Mr. and Mrs. Lahr, and he was very upset about it. He was a kindly man. He was very, very shy, as most of those people are. On stage, he was, you know, everything, but off stage, he was very quiet. So I spent a fair amount of time with him, and I honestly believe that he did not say it. I couldn't, all the conversations I had with him, and he was a real trooper. No matter there were only 15 people in the theater, he'd just go flat out, they all would. Marvelous group of people. And I was there when they were doing their, getting ready for, the first show for opening night, And we were in that cold, cold, cold community hall. There was no heat on, and you know, nothing like a closed-up place. And I can still see all these young dancers with their great heavy knee warmers on, massive heels, going through their routine. And the producer and the directors, and we were all, so they invited me in because I was working for Time. And it was quite thrilling to watch professionals. Mm. And I can remember this Lewis saying, "We start work 2 days from now. I don't expect anyone to get a cold. I don't expect anyone to break a leg. In fact, I don't expect anyone to die because that show is going on every night." And just sort of gave me goosebumps. And listen, this was the real thing. It was an exciting year. It really was. So anyway, fortunately, I was right in the middle of it all, and I kept a journal every night, and we almost ended up in jail. They said if we wrote one more check, we would go to jail. But we survived. And Dawson has its tourist business. If it hadn't been for all that stuff, I'm sure, going off, there wouldn't have been a Palace Grand, and that was the peg that they hung their tourist business on. We had campers coming in, trundling over the road, and they were parking in front of the hospital where there was an outflow, and we realized that was not good. So we decided to make a campground. So my husband and three or four of the men went out, and we got a bulldozer and flattened out an area. And we built little toilets, a pink one and a blue one, and somebody stole the pink one.
This is before the outhouse race even.
Yes, it sure was. And one of the pilots came in and said, "I think I spotted it. I think I spotted it." It wasn't. Somebody else had built one out someplace. And we used to go down and visit with them all. And the Mary Gart side and Lil Monroe and Mac, we painted murals on these things. Painted the whole thing. And the dentist contributed a cook stove. There just simply wasn't any money. If you wanted these things for your community, you did it. Mm-hmm. So we had the very first campground with a cook stove and benches and murals and two outhouses. And we'd go down, and those that had gardens would take some lettuce down or something. We got to know these people very well. So that was really the first RV campground in the Yukon. We put out the first tourist brochures. I remember I wrote those, and we scraped up enough money to have them printed. We were in, it was really exciting.
You were in business.
Oh, we were, and it was so much fun. We were young and full of vim and vigor, and it was exciting.
It's now worthwhile
to,
doing.
Oh, yeah, and now to go back and see how it's grown. The museum that we almost went to jail for stealing things for to get them in there. Father Bob was our greatest aid and comfort. He had a pickup, and he'd steal things just as fast as we would get them into the museum before some American came along and stole them. And it's nice to go down there and see all the stuff, the original claim stake. That was, and Big Alec McDonald's piano was there. I asked about it. And a man called Anker Hoidel had the claim stake, and he'd bought the Big Al at McDonald's piano. And when he and three or four men were out prospecting, they were out in the woods sitting around the fire one night, and apparently Anker said, "I have Big Al at McDonald's piano." Well, they all knew that. And he said, "I also have the original claim stake, the one that was first driven into the ground on Discovery." So he said, "If anything happens to me, I would like that to go to the Dawson Museum." Well, he died in a plane crash shortly after that, hardly any length of time after that. So Raymond came in, and someone else came to me and said, "Would you take this project on? It's going to be lengthy," but he wanted that piano, but there was really nothing written. It was just their witnessing this. And Anker Hordahl was Norwegian. So then I had to find someone to write a letter to the family, because this was in the hands of the public executive by this time. And Hans, name escapes me, he was in charge of the CBC here, and he was Norwegian. So he wrote the letters, and I fired them off to Norway, and it was quite a correspondence. So they finally said, "Yes, we will let you take the claim stake and the piano and turn it over to the Dawson Museum." So the RCMP and I waded in our knees up to this cabin, and the RCMP opened it, and I went in and pointed out the stake and the piano, and they put a tag on it. So they're in the Dawson Museum. And they didn't know they had the claim stake.
And did they find it when you...
Oh, it was somewhere. We were coming around in a display cabinet. My husband said, "Look, there's that stake that they said they didn't know they had." And there it was. They haven't got it tagged as the original because they didn't know the treasure they had. And the piano, she said, oh, this must be the piano. I said, no, that isn't the piano. This was a small one with a little candelabra on it, little candle holders on the side. It was a very dark wood. So it is in a case as part of their what was shipped into Dawson, trunks and cases and boxes and sacks, and including a piano, which I think was rather clever because they have it all glassed in and in a crate. So there is Big Alan McDonald's piano. Then I was walking by and there was my hat that had been given to me by Mrs. Chapman in turn her daughter, so it's there. So it was very important, all the things that we started, you know.